Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why does the United States have such difficulty prosecuting former leaders for their crimes? And what can the U.S. learn from other countries that have prosecuted its former presidents? We revisit that topic. And first, what is former Attorney General Pam Bondi's legacy at the Department of Justice? Is the Trump administration unique in using the department for political gain? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The Department of Justice historically has been pretty independent from the White House. While the Attorney General is appointed by the president, the Senate approves the candidate, and then most justice departments seek an independence and a focus on the rule of law. But Donald Trump's Department of Justice seems to have been different. Recently fired Attorney General Pam Bondi sought to prosecute the president's political opponents, and the department has gone to great lengths to protect the president in the revelations of who is in the Epstein files. On today's show, we're going to discuss the legacy of Pam Bondi as Attorney General, what this means for the future of the Justice Department. Our guest is Austin Sarrett. He is William Nelson Cromwell, Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science at Amherst College. He's the editor of Is Democracy Doomed? And Lethal Injection and the False Promise of Humane Execution, as well as Pam Bondi's Extreme Political Loyalty to Trump Wasn't Enough to Save Her Job. That last piece you can find online in the conversation. Professor Sarrett, Austin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, first question. In my intro, I suggested that Pam Bondi and Donald Trump's Department of Justice is kind of breaking norms from the DOJ. How accurate is that statement?
I think it's accurate, but not quite as accurate as people might think. It's accurate because Bondi was brought in to do a job, and the job was overtly political. The Justice Department has never been completely separated from politics. So Bondi is continuous with a tradition, which we'll talk about, I hope, in a bit, of attorneys general who are political allies of the President of the United States. The difference is that instead of aspiring to independence, she seemed to aspire to be the instrument of President Trump's revenge.
I mean, I know historically, different attorneys general have been, you know, quite close to the president. Immediately, obviously, JFK's brother, Robert Kennedy, was attorney general. What exactly, then, is that relationship? You said that it's a political ally. I mean, somebody, clear it's going to be somebody who the president agrees with. But how much is the perception that the Department of Justice should do what the president wants them to do, as opposed to just sort of broadly agree on questions of jurisprudence?
So let's first hop back 50 years. So this conversation about the Justice Department, its role, and what its relationship was to the president really hit a high point during Watergate. You may remember that Nixon appointed as Attorney General John Mitchell, who ended up going to jail because of his role in the Watergate cover-up. And Nixon wanted to prosecute his political enemies. So the Bondi Justice Department can look back 50 years and see its predecessor, look in the rearview mirror, and see John Mitchell. Now, Mitchell and Bondi were unusual, again, in the way in which they were ready to be enlisted in a crusade against the president's enemies. But now let's step back from Watergate, literally to the beginning of the Republic. The first Attorney General of the United States, a man named Edmund Randolph, was a very close ally of George Washington. Now, the Justice Department itself wasn't created until decades later in the middle of the 19th century. And if you look over time, there's been a kind of oscillation from attorneys general who were primarily regarded as political actors. They were chosen because they were political allies to the president. That's one tradition. Post-Watergate, another tradition, and that is attorneys general who aspired to have some independence or some distance from the president. So historically, we've kind of gone back and forth, though, as you indicated right at the beginning, the Trump Justice Department is unprecedented in the overtness of its willingness to be the president's instrument.
So on that question, the term lawfare keeps coming up, the idea of using the law, sort of a combination of law and warfare. And one of the great ironies of this is that in 2024, Donald Trump ran in part claiming Joe Biden was waging lawfare against him because of those prosecutions. So I guess first question is Trump's accusation, is it valid, and that we've seen this elevation of prosecutions for political purposes, whether it's from the Biden administration, say in the last 10 years or so? What do you make of that accusation?
Well, if the accusation is that turnabout is fair play, I think the accusation is wrong. The Biden Justice Department did what a Justice Department is supposed to do, which they investigated crimes. They didn't target people. Prosecution of Donald Trump was grounded in evidence of serious wrongdoing. Now, whether he should have been prosecuted, right? Because prosecution is never mandatory. Prosecutors have to have probable cause, but probable cause doesn't mean they have to prosecute. So we could argue that there was a political judgment made that this case was worth pursuing. But that judgment in the Biden administration was grounded in evidence of wrongdoing. It's not that the Biden Justice Department went after Trump because Biden didn't like him or because they thought of Trump as their political opponent. Under the current president in his now second term, well, that's changed. Pam, we got to get going on. And then he names the people. It's one thing to prosecute a crime when the person who committed that crime allegedly is a political figure. It's another thing to prosecute the person because they're a political figure.
Yeah, it seems sort of in support of your argument, the idea that the current DOJ under Donald Trump has been prosecuting for political purposes as opposed to, following the evidence. The record is pretty poor on these prosecutions that the DOJ, has advanced, isn't it? I mean, most of these cases are being thrown out, and even despite the famous phrase that, a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich, it seems like there's not even a ham sandwich there in a lot of these cases. Is again, how accurate is that, for the record, that sort of the evidence that there isn't a whole lot of crime there is they're really having difficulty getting, even any formal indictments, aren't they?
Well, if you are a baseball fan and unfortunately an aficionado of the Boston Red Sox, you get very used to losing. And that's what the Trump Justice Department has had to get used to. They have a very poor record, indictments thrown out, indictments not returned. And that the record, the poverty of that record goes back to what we talked about a minute ago. Namely, the difference between the Biden Justice Department and the Trump Justice Department is the Trump Justice Department is going forward with prosecutions that can't get to first base. And that indicates that judges, including some appointed by Donald Trump, and citizens acting as grand jurors see pretty clearly that there is no evidence of crime, whether it's Jim Comey or Letitia James, to name two, Jerome Powell. There's no evidence of crime.
And is there any precedent for that a president asking Department of Justice to target not just even just political opponents, but to specifically say, these individuals, I think that they are criminals, so therefore you should prosecute them? Or is this individual targeting something new?
Well, I don't want you to think that I'm stuck in Watergate, but remember, Nixon had an enemies list. There's a difference because Nixon wanted to keep his enemies list quiet. Trump wants to broadcast his enemies list. So you have to think about the Justice Department today as not just playing a role in trying to send people to jail, but playing a role in sending people a message. No matter how powerful you are, no matter how well placed you are, you're vulnerable to being targeted. John Bolton. So I think that we all need to remember that it is remarkable how overt the current administration has been in announcing its agenda and in pursuing its agenda. And I think that, well, the one loss record matters, but even when they lose, they win in sending a message. We could come after you at any moment.
Yeah, because this week, and we're recording on a Friday on April 17th, that this week there's a new story, not necessarily coming out of the Justice Department. It was coming out of Central Intelligence about two more referrals for potential criminal behavior. And it was the two people seemingly most responsible for his first impeachment, the whistleblower and then the inspector general. And so I take it that would fit that same model. I mean, they keep losing, but they keep threatening prosecutions.
So, the classic movie about people who go to prison shows the following scene. The new person comes into prison and they take a rock and they go after the biggest, baddest person in the yard because they want to send a message that they won't be intimidated. And from the moment President Trump returned to the Oval Office, he's wanted to send that message. Go after the biggest, most prestigious law firms. Go after the biggest, richest, most prestigious universities. Targeting individuals is another way to say there's a new sheriff in town. And the president seems to be in love with the idea that real power depends upon force and that the application of force well used multiplies intimidation. And that calculus, be public, go after big targets, apply force and intimidate, I think was the animating spirit of the Bondi Justice Department. And I see no reason to expect that it's going to change under Acting Attorney General Todd Blanchard.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today we're talking about the Department of Justice, the legacy of Pam Bondi as Attorney General, questions about how different or how similar the Donald Trump's Department of Justice has been historically, and also what does this say about the future of the Justice Department? Our guest today is Austin Sarrett. He is from Amherst College. And so, Austin, we've been talking so far about the way in which the Department of Justice was weaponized, this lawfare. But I want to turn to the other role that Pam Bondi's Justice Department has played, and that's actually been covering up. So, first, can you give us sort of an update on what the status is within the Justice Department about the case about the Epstein files? And because I mean, I know the Justice Department was ordered via congressional act to release the Epstein files. What did Pam Bondi do when ordered to release the Epstein files, and what led to that congressional order to release them?
So the Epstein files have a kind of mythic status in our lives. The Epstein files are like the Rosetta Stone. And there've been a lot of argument actually on both sides about whether the Epstein files should be released at all. I mean, there are progressives who said, no, they shouldn't be released because that kind of data dump will be broad brush in what in the people it tars. What Bondi promised was a release of the files. And you remember then she released these binders, which some influencers and right-wing podcasters came out and showed. And then she said, well, but she had the files on her desk when pressed that those weren't enough. and she would release them. She then kind of denies that they existed. I mean, one of the things that's great about the current administration is their motto should be don't believe what you see and don't believe what you hear. A lot of agitation, appropriate agitation from survivors and others who said, you promised to be transparent, you promised to release these files, and the Justice Department did very little until Congress passed legislation. That legislation required the release of the entire set of Epstein files, redacted for confidentiality and to protect victims, by a date certain. Justice Department released some of those files, but blew well past the deadline. And we really still don't know how much of the Epstein files the Justice Department has and what they're going to do with them. Now, cover up, Watergate. So implicating the Justice Department or engaging the Justice Department in a kind of cover up, not unprecedented. Troubling, but not unprecedented.
And so, I mean, when you mention Watergate and the Justice Department, I immediately think then of what at the time was, quite a political struggle, even a scandal. And that was when Nixon insisted that the special prosecutor be fired. And two different attorneys general chose not to fire the special prosecutor. I mean, eventually Nixon got him fired. He, eventually went to the number three man, Robert Bork, to fire Archibald Cox. Did that assert the independence of the Department of Justice, or did that just, demonstrate that though it may be a political pain, the president will get what he wants?
Well, I think it illustrated both. I mean, Elliot Richardson refused to fire Archibald Cox. Robert Bork did. So I think the line between law and politics is sometimes a difficult one to chart. And what I was saying to you earlier is that in the history of the Justice Department, there's these oscillations, but there's something very different. In 1974, the Congress of the United States seemed to be alive and well and demanding accountability. In 2026, the Congress of the United States seems to be acquiescing in a lot of the shenanigans that Bondi perpetrated. Not the Epstein files, they passed that legislation, but you haven't heard a lot of noise since then. We're going to hold you in contempt, we're going to have hearings. So, if you think about the Justice Department as kind of sitting uneasily at the intersection of law and politics, one of the things that keeps the politics in check is the kind of ballast that is put around the Justice Department by the Congress, by the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, the Judiciary Committee in the House. And what was remarkable after Watergate was a spate of legislation designed to make sure that Watergate didn't happen again, including the passage of the so-called Presidential Records Act. Now, my favorite little obscure insight into the Trump Justice Department happened, I don't know, 10 days ago when the Office of Legal Counsel, which has long been regarded as the most professionalized branch of the Justice Department, issued an opinion saying that the Presidential Records Act was unconstitutional and that the President of the United States could do whatever they wanted with those records. I mean, that's a Nixonian dream. And that tells you a lot, I think, about where the Justice Department is when the OLC would issue such an opinion, compared to what happened after Watergate when we were trying to clean up the mess. Right now, it seems that the Justice Department is helping to make the mess.
Now, in keeping with the second theme then of the use of the Justice Department to protect allies of the president or try to protect the president with the Epstein files, Donald Trump has issued quite a number of pardons. So I guess two questions. One is, how historic, is this fairly consistent with the use of the pardons? And a second, does the Justice Department play any role in reviewing files for pardon, or is it really just the whim of the president?
Well, until the Trump presidency, at least in the modern period, it wasn't reliably the whim of the president. There's an Office of the Pardon Attorney in the Justice Department, and there was a systematic process for reviewing applications for clemency. Now, some presidents, like Bill Clinton in the last minutes of his presidency, haven't worried so much about the formalities. Donald Trump is a real outlier. He's sidelined really the Office of the Pardon Attorney in granting pardons. He's granted a tremendous number of pardons and clemencies, commutations in his first year in office. But I've got some bad news about the clemency power. The clemency power has been described by the United States Supreme Court as a plenary power of the president. Other courts have said presidents can grant pardons or commutations for good reason or bad reason or no reason at all. So there are very few, and I say very few, I really think none, but very few constraints on the ability of a president to wield the clemency power. And again, that conversation about ballast used to come from the Justice Department itself in the Office of the Pardon Attorney. That's gone. Trump appointed a loyalist, a reliable conservative, to be the head of that office, and mostly has ignored that office as he's gone about his business of granting clemency.
So, sort of our last topic that I want to wrestle with then is I think it's fair to say that there's little expectation that the relationship between the Department of Justice and the rest of the White House is going to change just because Pam Bondi is no longer Attorney General. But if in 2028 or 2032 or whenever Democrats are back in the White House, or perhaps Republican that's not necessarily a Trump loyalist is in the White House, there could be some expectation of reforms. I mean, that's what happened with Watergate, that after Watergate there was this perception that we needed to change the way the Department of Justice and its relationship with the president, and there were a series of reforms. Do you expect then that with the political fallout from the Epstein files, from the pardons, with the political lawfare, that there's going to be a move to try to reform the Department of Justice, that there's going to be revisiting some of these, and might even possibly go further than what some of the Watergate reforms proposed?
Well, I'm going to do something that a college professor should never do. I don't know. Don't tell my colleagues. So, surely there'll be a push in some parts of the Democratic Party and the whatever is left of the so-called establishment, to make sure that what happened under Trump can never happen again. Well, but that depends on a whole lot of things, including Democratic control of the House and the Senate. But here we need to take a lesson from what happened when Trump asked the governor of Texas to reapportion in mid cycle. Michelle Obama famously said, "When they go low, we go high." The response to the Greg Abbott thing was, "When they go low, we got to go low too." So I could see a scenario in which there'd be a fig leaf of reform, but a continuation of some kind of politicization of the Justice Department. I think it will be a lively contest, a lively debate, should the Democrats ever again control the White House and the Congress, about what reforms are needed, how far those reforms should go, and how insulated the Justice Department should be from the President of the United States.
Yeah, and it seems to me one of the big divides, within the Democrats is the number of Democrats who are insisting that there needs to be prosecutions for what's been going on in Trump 2.0, that there needs to be some sort of judicial reckoning, which suggests to me that it'd be awfully tempting to take all of these new powers the president has when there's a Democrat in the White House and actually use those powers.
Well, the question is, Donald Trump, the Wall Street Journal reports that Donald Trump allegedly said that before he leaves office, he's going to pardon everybody who came within 200 yards of the Oval Office. So you could imagine a scenario in which Trump granted pardons preemptively to vast numbers of his political allies and associates. That doesn't mean that at the end of the day, the Democrats aren't going to try to find some way to hold people accountable if they ever return to power. But we're kind of stuck. I need to make up for my admission that I didn't know something by citing an obscure, not so obscure text, namely Machiavelli's The Prince. By the way, I have a dream of offering a course called From Innocence to Worldliness. It would start with The Little Prince and end with Machiavelli's The Prince. But you'll remember the line in Machiavelli. He said, "Among the many who are vicious, the virtuous surely comes to grief. And the prince needs to learn how not to be good and to use it or not according to need." So the calculus about do we take the high road, or do we do to them what they did to us? That calculus is not an easy one. And as I said, I can't tell you how it would come out once the de Democrats, if the Democrats return to power.
I think that's a good place to stop because at the end of the day, I think it's best to view this as a as an ongoing political drama. We don't know how this is going to play itself out, but I think you've done a good job sort of laying out what are the issues that we should be watching. We've been talking about the role of the Department of Justice, the politicization of the Department of Justice, the targeted prosecutions, as well as the targeted cover-ups in Pam Bondi's Department of Justice and what the future of the DOJ looks like. Our guest today has been Austin Sarrett. He is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science at Amherst College. He's the editor of Is Democracy Doomed? And Lethal Injection and the False Promise of Humane Execution, as well as an article in The Conversation entitled Pam Bondi's Extreme Political Loyalty to Trump Wasn't Enough to Save Her Job. Professor Sarrett, thank you so much for your time, for your expertise, and for your insights. And I look forward to future conversations as we see these things develop.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, while the Department of Justice has sought to prosecute political opponents, what does it say about the United States that it has not prosecuted former presidents for crimes they may have committed? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is prosecuting or choosing not to prosecute former political leaders purely a political decision? How common are such prosecutions? And are the prosecutions of former heads of state weaponization of justice? Or are they attempts to uphold the rule of law? We are rebroadcasting part of an hour-long discussion. You can find the full discussion at www.scholarcircle.org. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. We're exploring the impact of the prosecution of Donald Trump, the American challenge of prosecuting former heads of states, and looking abroad with a bit of a comparative perspective on other countries who actually have been successful at prosecuting heads of states. So our panel for this second half of the show are Jeremy Suri, who is at the University of Texas at Austin, and Ezequiel Gonzalez Ocantis at the University of Oxford. So Jeremy, this question about how unique this prosecution is in the United States and the way in which Trump supporters have tried to categorize this actually rather like this is a third world country, the weaponization of the Department of Justice to get rid of a political figure that they don't want to run, or even just the norm that if you're running for president, you shouldn't face prosecution. How effective are those arguments at least putting in the minds that any form of prosecution is political rather than legal in nature?
Great question, Doug. So let's start with the latter part of your question. The argument that because someone is running for president, that person cannot be prosecuted is just patently ridiculous. It has no historical basis. And if you thought about it, it would mean that anyone charged with a crime, if they run for president, they don't have to be charged with a crime. They get to forestall any prosecution. So that would mean that, you know, if a major corporate leader or a major celebrity, you know, committed a crime, celebrity Y could say, well, I'm running for president, you can't prosecute me. So this is a very silly argument. Concerns about weaponization of the Justice Department. Now, those could be serious concerns. We would not want to see the Justice Department being used against political enemies. And in the past, it has been. We should remember that the Justice Department was used, for instance, to harass civil rights activists. It was used to harass anti-war activists. So there have been times under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover in the FBI, and actually even during the attorney generalship of Robert Kennedy, when the Justice Department was misused. That is why we have a number of safeguards that have been built in this situation. The Attorney General and the Special Counsel have not had any, as far as we know, any direct interaction with the President of the United States. They have not consulted him with regard to the prosecutions of Donald Trump. There has been a wall created between them. And as far as we can tell, President Biden has done everything he can to reinforce that separation. That is the judicial norm. The members of the Justice Department who are pursuing the various prosecutions against Donald Trump, they are mostly professional civil servants. They are not political appointees. They are people who would remain in their jobs regardless of who the president was. And there's good reason to believe that some of them are Republicans, some of them are Democrats. I would remind, for instance, our listeners that Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI, is actually a Republican. He's a registered Republican as such. So the notion that this is a partisan inquiry through the Justice Department really doesn't hold much water here. It's one of the cases, Doug, where I think we've learned a lot from the mid-20th century when we did have politically biased prosecutions. But one final point, that is one of the issues that will come up in the judicial proceedings. And the judges and jury will be able to assess whether the evidence that has been presented is being presented in a way that is persuasive of a criminal prosecution, regardless of politics. So in a certain way, this is an argument designed to distract us right now and get us not to focus on what are the real issues, which are the alleged crimes against the democratic system that are being prosecuted here.
And actually, real quick, Jack Smith, you know, obviously the prosecutor that's brought some of these charges, isn't new to bringing charges against presidential candidates, correct? I mean, he led the prosecution against John Edwards, if I remember correctly. And so running for public office or having run for public office before certainly doesn't have a historical precedent for leaving you, I guess, perpetually immune.
And there's no evidence that Jack Smith was in any way some kind of highly partisan figure of any kind. He spent much of his career also overseas in The Hague,
right,
prosecuting human rights violations by heads of state and others. And let's also make the point that Merrick Garland, even though he was appointed by Biden to be attorney general and was nominated by Obama for the Supreme Court, there's no long history of partisanship by Merrick Garland either. These are seasoned legal figures who have a professional coterie of lawyers working for them who are doing their job, which is to prosecute crimes where they see it. And it will be the job of judges and juries to assess those prosecutions.
Ezekiel, we've talked a lot about Peru, but the one case we've referenced it a couple of times that immediately came to mind for me as far as accusations of weaponization, of questions of justice, et cetera, is Brazil, where you get the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. And that certainly those on the left in Brazil saw that as being just completely partisan, trying to get rid of a president that they disagreed with. And of course, the prosecution, imprisonment, and then eventual exoneration of Lula, the current president. So the question is, how much can we in the U.S. following, you know, these cases, learn from the Brazilian experience about the political and legal ramifications?
Yeah, so I would separate sort of the impeachment and the corruption prosecution, because of course the dynamics there are quite different. But I would say this debate about whether or not the criminal justice institutions are being weaponized or not is the nature of the beast. You can't expect high-level politicians to remain passive bystanders that allow, you know, prosecutors to destroy their political careers. They're going to fight back. And the best way to do that is try to delegitimize what these prosecutors or investigators or the police or whoever is in charge, what they're doing, right? By saying, you know, well, this is a witch hunt. Or as I was saying in the first half of the show, in Latin America, they use the term lawfare, the idea of warfare via the law. In Italy, you know, Berlusconi, who had benefited massively from the clean hands operation that destroyed the party system and allowed him to rise as an outsider. Well, when that turned against him, he called the judges the red judges, you know, the communist judges that were coming against him. So, you know, this is not unique to the United States. Now, what I understand is that these debates, I think, about weaponization play out differently depending on the political context. And so let me give you a comparison from Latin America. It is very different for someone with an audience to cry foul. And by an audience, I mean with a party system that's relatively polarized, that, you know, allows these people to have supporters that are going to believe them. So one thing is to cry foul and call things a witch hunt or lawfare in that sort of context. That narrative is likely to catch on because there are people willing to believe it, because it's politically expedient to believe it. And quite another thing is to try and sort of cry foul or lawfare in a context like Peru, for example, where parties are notoriously non-existent or weak, where no citizen feels particularly victimized because a leader is going to jail, right? Because no one likes politicians, no one identifies with politicians. Those who cry foul don't have an audience. So the lawfare and witch hunt narrative didn't catch on in Peru. So I think this polarizing dynamics that these prosecutions exacerbate are sort of part and parcel of the issue, right?
No, absolutely. And mentioning parties is the perfect transition then to ask you, Jeremy, what's really striking about this whole process, this whole political process, is how much Trump's political rivals, others running for the nomination, not only are not making this criminality an issue of Trump, but instead rallying to his support, with the noted exception of people like Chris Christie. Most of the candidates are echoing Trump's argument and really bolstering him. Is this just a lack of political acumen, the opportunity for political figures to kind of push Trump out of the way to try to get the nomination? Or what is it about the party identification with Trump that makes this counterintuitive to somebody who's just kind of following politics?
Right. You would think that Americans would believe in the rule of law, and that someone who was facing four indictments, that this would be a heavy burden for them to carry. And perhaps it is for the general electorate. But for the Republican primary voters, and let's just remind ourselves, Republican primary voters are the most extreme members of the party. For those who will show up at an Iowa caucus or vote in the New Hampshire primary, they really identify themselves with Trump and Trump's positions on certain issues, for instance, on the border and various other things, and they don't like an attack on their man. And so what the Republican rivals of Trump are trying to do is they're trying to actually criticize some of his actions without calling for his prosecution. And so it was interesting how most of the candidates said they believed that Mike Pence did the right thing by not following Trump's orders, really is what they were, to violate the Constitution. And so they identified with the Constitution over Trump, but they then did not identify with holding Trump accountable to the Constitution legally. And this is just a political maneuver they're trying. I think in the long run, Doug, this is a losing position for Republicans, because I think in a general election, it's very hard to admit that someone was pushing the boundaries of constitutional law and not say that they should be held accountable. And that's going to be a problem for mainstream voters. I think the position of condemning Trump and calling for his prosecution, as to some extent Chris Christie is probably a better long-term position for the Republicans.
Now, but to follow up what Zihiel was saying is that as political scientists, if we're thinking about how to explain why, you know, individuals will rally behind the person who's being prosecuted versus not, party identification, I guess, it would suggest that that would play a huge role, that in political systems where the parties are extremely fluid, then they're just individuals and you can cast them aside. But what's striking here is how much, first of all, party identification is quite strong in the United States, the partisanship driven by party identification. And one thing Donald Trump has done that's really remarkable in my eyes is made being a Republican is about supporting Trump, rather than vice versa, about, you know, a set of principles and whether or not the leader supports that. He's convinced Republicans that conservative members of the party that who don't like him are somehow Rhino, Republican in name only. So is this a manifestation of that? Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I see it less as being a partisan manifestation and more as the manifestation of a charismatic caudillo figure. And he has hijacked the party. And when people say they're Republicans, I think in some cases, particularly among primary voters, that's a stand-in for being a Trump supporter. And they're really not Republican Party supporters any longer. And we can see that by him not even being at the Republican debate. And Republicans still saying he's our candidate, right? So I think what we've moved into is a space where people identify by party, but in fact, what is motivating them is much more the individual figure. I'm sure Ezekiel will have some examples of this from Latin America and elsewhere. I think of this as a kind of Gaullist situation where you have a figure who, for at least some set of voters, transcends party identification.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing prosecuting heads of state from both the American and a comparative perspective with Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas, Austin, and Ezekiel Gonzalez Ocantas from the University of Oxford. And Ezekiel, I think that's a great transition then to think about, I mean, in Brazil, you had this rare case where there's one political party that seems, you know, where the party isn't just about an individual, the Labor Party with Rousseff being impeached, Lula being prosecuted, versus the tradition in many Latin American countries, including in Brazil, where parties are just mechanisms for individuals. Is that really pretty strong, you know, variable in determining how much these accusations of weaponization of social media actually will, or excuse me, weaponization of prosecutions, how much that those charges actually find some real roots?
So politicians who reach the presidency without parties, which are increasingly common in Latin America, especially because they coalesce sort of an anti-establishment vote, as it were, and they win by building negative coalitions as opposed to sort of positive coalitions, often tend to, because of the lack of, you know, a political trajectory and political party, they lack legislative shields that can sort of shield them from impeachment and these sorts of things. So they tend to be quite weak and quite susceptible to sort of corruption charges or impeachment proceedings and whatnot. Parties like the Workers Party in Brazil are obviously very, very different. And so it is in context where you have partisans, as I was saying earlier, where you are more likely to see this debates about weaponization sort of catching on, as it was, as I was saying. Now, if you look at the opinion polls in Brazil during the sort of the car wash operation that you were mentioning, the one that sort of prosecuted Lula, there was a time at the peak of the prestige of the operation when it was very hard to protect partisans of the Workers' Party, because, you know, the Workers' Party was sort of at the center of that scandal. Now, very quickly, that changed. And that changed as this narrative of weaponization caught on. And the reason for that is that, you know, the investigation on the one hand or investigations like these promise to, you know, clean politics, to redeem institutions and whatnot, but often do so in ways that are, as we were talking about at the beginning, are quite controversial. And so they feed and they sort of legitimize this weaponization argument, even if they're not doing things that are plainly legal. In Brazil, this is probably true that they were bending the law too much. In other contexts, they were perhaps not, and yet they still fell prey to that sort of narrative. So in many ways, you know, these investigations can, in principle, strengthen the rule of law by sort of holding these people accountable. But on the other hand, because of the very nature of what they need to do in order to succeed, right, which is to innovate, to investigate very difficult crimes and whatnot, they end up sort of undermining that project, at least in the minds of many voters. To put it simply and in slightly sort of more political science-y terms, I would say that the controversy is not just political ones around who's being prosecuted, but about the how they're being prosecuted. What they do is they turn corruption or, you know, illegality from a valence issue. Who doesn't want to fight corruption? Who doesn't want to sort of defeat, you know, a graft and whatnot, into a rather controversial issue? So when you operationalize anti-corruption, for example, in very concrete ways, it stops being a matter of consensus. Anti-corruption is no longer something we all want. And there are some who don't want it because it affects their political interests, and others who don't want it because they think it's too destabilizing, and others don't want it because they think you've got anti-corruption via means or mechanisms that undermine the rule of law.
And then for that question, Ezekiel, I'll direct this to you. The U.S., the defenders of, you know, other prosecutions, Jeremy certainly highlighted the independence of the prosecutorial office, the judicial actors being as independent as possible, and certainly, you know, projecting, you know, this level of independence, the judges themselves, the grand juries, you know, being independent. Is that typically been the experience throughout Latin America, that there's a real emphasis on those bringing the prosecutions really are independent actors, judicial actors with an interest in the rule of law and not partisan?
Well, one of the reasons why you see the explosion of corruption prosecutions, for example, in Latin America in recent years, is because there's been a gradual process. There's been different streams of institutional reforms that have really enhanced the autonomy of the prosecution services as a whole. But also reforms that have created within the prosecution services, because they can often be captured anyway at the top, within the prosecution services, islands of bureaucratic autonomy, or however you want to call them, usually in the form of prosecutorial units specialized in different forms of macro criminality. So, for example, human trafficking, money laundering, corruption, those sorts of things. And so these units operate like mini combat cells within this prosecution services and are able to defend themselves from political attacks, to amass the expertise necessary to investigate complex crimes. So in many ways, this wave of prosecutions is the result of greater independence. The problem is that that independence also needs to be dramatized in ways that are credible for these prosecutions not to fall prey of these shenanigans, right? Of these lawfare, weaponization, witch hunts, right? And that is very difficult. That is really, really hard. Because as I said earlier, these prosecutors need to be unusually aggressive and unusually unorthodox in order to be able to get to the bottom of these crimes and be able to present evidence in front of a court of law and get convictions. And so when you are aggressive and unorthodox, maybe the problem is not that you're not independent, but the problem is that you're acting, so perhaps, you know, legally or out of character or whatever.
Jeremy, sort of the last topic we're going to take up, these cases against Trump, the dates that, you know, scheduling the beginning of the trial, et cetera, are certainly in flux. But there's some expectation that he's actually going to be on trial during 2024, you know, in election year. So how much are the trials themselves really just political theater? And how much is it going to be played up as political theater? And I guess you can put on a bit of a predictive hat, although, I for one, and will respect you saying I don't want to predict anything. But what kind of impact do you imagine it's going to have, this political theater, on the American presidential race?
Well, I think the prosecutions as a whole are both serious legal matters and political theater. And we should not confuse those two things. They are two separate things. They overlap at times. But, you know, as the president goes in and is fingerprinted and they do a mugshot, in Fulton County, Georgia. That's a serious matter, and none of us would like to go through that. It's also political theater for him and for those who are prosecuting him. So both things are happening at the same time. I think we can safely predict that for the first time in our history, the serious legal proceedings against a major political candidate will interfere with the campaign. How that will interfere, we're not sure. But there will be hearings. There will probably be at least one of these trials during the campaign. There will be other things that will emerge. We might get subsequent prosecutions. We might get new subpoenas. We will certainly get new evidence that will emerge. And it will be both a distraction and an additive to the way this campaign proceeds. I do think there will be one serious challenge that Trump will face beyond the substance of these, which is the allocation of his time. Prosecutions in the United States take a long time. A trial takes a long time. And he has to be there. And that will take him away from the campaign trail. And he will not be able to use a courtroom as a campaign platform because the judge will be in control. I mean, the courtroom is the worst possible place for Trump because someone else controls the rules and someone else controls who speaks. It's exactly the kind of space he's generally avoided. So I do think that will have a deep effect. And I'll bring up one other point that I've been thinking about is going through this process is stressful. I mean, imagine facing the possibility, even if you think you're going to get off, the possibility of going to jail. I think that also has an effect on an individual's psyche and on an individual's health. There's no doubt that Slobodan Milosevic, the former leader of Serbia, who died during his trial, I think the trial was one of the precipitating causes of his ill health. And I'm not saying that will necessarily happen, but I don't think this candidate, I don't think this individual, Trump, will be the same when he comes out of this process as he is going in.
And it makes me think, Ezekiel, from political theater perspective, again, Lula being in jail and becoming the candidate of choice for the PT and then being exonerated through that process certainly helped to elevate his political position, since that he had, you know, fought the fight and had won. First of all, is that accurate, that actually by winning, you know, by being exonerated, it put him in a stronger position when he ran against Jair Bolsonaro? And some of the same observations that Jeremy made about the US, can we draw on Brazil as an example?
I mean, it is true that his exoneration sort of vindicated and sort of validated his sort of accusation, his claim that what he experienced was a form of judicial persecution or lawfare. But I think the best example in terms of comparing it to what might happen in the US, in the United States, is not Lula, but Cristina Kirchner in Argentina. So Cristina Kirchner has been convicted, actually, as she's actually the sitting vice president, and she was convicted while she was vice president. For crimes that were committed when she was president. And she used the courtroom the courtroom and the various instances of the judicial process as a platform. Now, of course, that came with its own limitations, as Jeremy was saying, because obviously she had someone who could rebut her arguments and she couldn't speak. But it became a focal point for rallying the troops around her. Now, that was very useful in terms of increasing the density of the support she had, but not necessarily the volume of the support she had, if you want to put it in those terms, right? It sort of consolidated the core constituents, but it didn't allow her to expand beyond that. And I think this relates to also to something Jeremy said earlier about, you know, the fact that this debate about, you know, persecution and witch hunts might be a good thing in the primaries, but it might be less of an asset in the general election when you need to go for the median voter. And I think this is a little bit also what happened in Argentina. So the victimization narrative was a bit of consolidate a non-trivial support base, but one that isn't enough to be competitive electorally.
So considering these issues, first of all, I think it's important that the United States and that Americans think about the question about prosecuting former heads of state from this international perspective. This is not something that's unique to the U.S. These charges aren't unique to the U.S. There's a lot of places, certainly throughout Latin America, referencing Berlusconi as another example. And so what's happening from a prosecutorial perspective, from a political perspective in the United States, is not unique though it may be unique to the United States. And ultimately, I think the questions that we raise today are really kind of ongoing questions that we're going to keep wrestling with, and the sorts of things that we should be thinking about, watching, and talking about as these prosecutions go forward. On today's show, we've talked about the question of prosecuting a former head of state, why it's been so difficult in the United States historically and politically, some examples from around the world, in particular in Latin America, and examining these questions from both an American and a comparative perspective. Our panel today has been Jeremy Suri. He's professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also the Matt Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and his latest book, Civil War by Other Means, America's Long and Unfinished Fight for Democracy. He's also the host of the podcast, This is Democracy. And Ezequiel Gonzalez Ocantos. He is the associate professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations and a professorial fellow of Newfield College at the University of Oxford. He is the author of Shifting Legal Visions, Judicial Change in Human Rights Trials in Latin America, and the co-author of Prosecutors, Voters, and the Criminalization of Corruption in Latin America. Thank you very, very much for joining us and sharing your expertise.
My pleasure.
This is part of an hour-long discussion. You can find the full discussion at www.scholarcircle.org.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sad Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.